Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to Needle Exchange, conversations on the art of thread. I'm Jamie Chalmers, aka Mr. X Stitch, and today I'm interviewing Lauren Batt. This is the second part of our Needle Exchange, and in this part we dive into Lauren's themed series. Ex-voto boxes, which are small wishes hung en masse. Guardian angels that gently hold everyday burdens like insomnia or being unheard. And her Sailing to a Better Place series, born from a need for hope. We also cover collaborations in a troglodyte chateau, oh yes, future animation dreams and why playful aesthetics can carry real social weight without confrontation. In that particular topic, I was really reminded of the work of Sally Maver. I interviewed her in Needle Exchanges 67 and 68, and there are definite similarities with the playful characters and the otherworldliness of it all. But if you like this episode, please leave a quick review as it helps other people find the show. Lauren's a great person. Be sure to check out her work on social media as well. I'll be back next week with someone different from the world of Stitch. But until then, enjoy the show. But it's interesting because you give yourself the option to have social commentary, but the layer of whimsy kind of... it like diffuses it a little bit. I was thinking about your guardian angels as well. You know, some of those are quite poignant angels. What was it? The guardian angel of belittled women all over the world? Or, you know, that's strong stuff. And yet, yeah, because you've got this whimsical aesthetic, maybe it makes it easier for people to face.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I don't know. There's so many things that are going through my head as I think about this. I've never seen myself as a social or political commentator because I don't have a good grasp on the complexity of that world, I would say. But at the same time, I'm thinking about a time when my husband was posted to Uruguay and we went to Buenos Aires in Argentina and he was working. And so I was walking around and I went into a church and just because it was so hot to escape the heat. And in the churches there, you know, they're just kind of dripping with all kinds of Baroque altars with sculptures and lots of blood and stuff. And there was this one really simple statue of Christ crucified with lots of blood drops coming down and nails all over the place. And I watched as this man came up and sort of held on to him and started talking to the statue. And I found that incredibly moving. I'm not religious myself, but watching this interaction and how the man took this object for the real thing that was listening to his problems and promising maybe an offer of help, that really got to me. And I wanted to convey that kind of attachment of your every man to this glimmer of hope, to this view of possibility in the world, even in times of trouble. And I did it in the way I knew how. In other words, I'm not going to sculpt a wooden crucifix.
There's something about people placing their faith in objects because it's easier than placing their faith in humans, almost, isn't it? Like an icon, it's easier because of the abstraction of it. Yeah, and they don't appear to have any frailties or weaknesses or whatever it is. And so it allows that
It's funny, isn't it? Because you feel like we should all just be able to talk to one another, but if we can't,
yeah,
and maybe talking to some rosary beads or something.
Yeah, and the object doesn't judge you either.
Mm.
And I think that can be problematic when we talk to actual people, even people who are close to us. So, I guess that's part of what I wanted to convey with these guardian angels, that a lot of us have very sort of quotidian, simple problems in our lives. They're not necessarily existential or shaking. They can be that you suffer from insomnia, or that you're disorganized, or that nobody listens to you, or you get the impression that nobody listens to you. And those were the kinds of issues that I wanted to treat with these guardian angels.
Yeah.
Some of them are a bit more existential, but
I could do with the guardian angel for helping me work out which of my daughter's clothes are which, because I have this color, I have this clothing blindness, right, where because my oldest daughter's grown out of clothes that are now my youngest daughter's, my brain's refusing to really peg those things. So I spend a lot of time holding up pants in front of my children, going, whose pants are these? And they'll tell me, and my wife will tell me, and it's just not sticking. So if there can be a guardian angel for that, I'm very happy.
Oh. I'm going to think about that.
I think it's St. Thomas or something. Like, if you lose things in your house, you're supposed to be able to call out St. Thomas and just go, where are my keys? God damn it. And he'll help you find it. Yeah.
I did make a guardian angel of mismatched socks.
There are literally nine. I've got nine odd socks on top of my daughter's. Like, I should have taken a photo. This is spooky. Please. Dear guardian angel. I remember talking to Sally Maver, and she makes little vignettes with characters. Yeah. And we had this thing about when you start to make social commentary, but you use playful objects. So again, it's that thing of it removes the reality from the situation, but at the same time, you're commenting on real issues.
Like, that's true. Yeah.
It has that extra thing. And that's what I mean. I think sometimes, even like you say, with the sort of post-pandemic pieces and this thing that we're going through now of social media allowing people to fall into these little like disenfranchised wormholes where they disassociate from the rest of society and suddenly it seems all right to be overtly racist or sexist or whatever. You know, it's all like algorithmically driven, and you're sort of commenting on that. But you're commenting on it with this medieval, charming poignancy that has these, you know, people sitting in the beautiful countryside by themselves, you know. And yet at the same time, it is that thing, isn't it? It's just you're just otherworlding it.
Yeah. You nailed it.
Thanks.
You nailed it. I think you're right that the slightly playful, charming aspect of it kind of excuses me. Mm-hmm. From being directly confrontational, which I am not, you know, I've got that Swedish thing in my background. You don't conflict. Kind of try and go for the consensus and bring people gently together. So I have trouble envisaging doing that confrontational attack in my work.
But there's plenty of people that do, so it's okay, isn't it? You don't need to. You can just go about it, and then, you know, I'd imagine every other series can be perfectly whimsical, you know, can just be playful and joyful. And because you've done like book illustration and stuff as well, haven't you?
I've done some children's book illustration. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's always that as a palate cleansing sorbet.
Yeah. Although the one of them was done, we moved, to Washington, I'm trying to think how many times. We moved back with the kids in 2000. And so we were there in 2001 for the terrorist attacks.
Right.
And everybody remembers what happened in New York, but it also happened in Washington on the Pentagon. And so it was a really tough time. And I actually went totally off making art for a while, because I could not see the sense in it. I didn't see what use it was, in a way. And so I could say that I was saved by this one children's book editor who I'd worked with before, who sent me a project, a sort of post-attack project of a book project on, you know, the world is, in French, is le monde est si grand, et moi je suis si petit. No, le monde est si grand. The world is so big. And in the end, you had this little kid who's saying, but, and I'm so small. But I can't remember what the punchline was. I still count or something like that. So it was, you know, it was sort of in response to the trauma and the violence of that time. And it really helped. It helped me a lot. It was good therapy for me. But I realized that I'm not, none of my books have been bestsellers. I'm not as good at telling a story over several pages as I am in just one image.
But it's interesting because just looking at some of the work on your website, some of the galleries, it seems like you tell stories through snapshots, like a collection of snapshots. And I don't know whether, like, for instance, is it the ex voto boxes? So these boxes that have these images in them, and they're, some of them are like, what, words of wisdom or words of warning, and then some of them are aspirational. But they're all like glimpses. And I don't know whether, do you make a run of those and then you're like, right, I've got those out of my system? Or do you bounce between different projects and over time accumulate, like the Sailing Away series, you know, do you make those because that's an itch that has to be scratched? Or do you make one, then maybe you've made a guardian angel, then you move on to another project? How does that kind of work?
It's more, I'm a bit of a square. I would say it's more itching, itching a need until I've itched it, which I rarely do. Usually something else, since I'm so slow, usually something else comes up to cut off the series. So the ex-voto boxes, they happened after the illustrating this book. And we moved back to Europe, and I did start, you know, walking in the streets and observing people again with a different, I would say, a post 9/11 view of humanity.
Okay.
And a kind of a desire to love people again. And so just observing people around me and wondering what small but important thing to them they might be desiring. So an ex voto technically is thanking some deus ex machina for saving the person from, you know, sure or sudden death, probably. So mine are more like wishing for something before it happens.
Yeah.
But something small often. And I had like a whole list of other boxes that I was ready to work on. And then... Just as a parenthesis, it kind of came about.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
But also because, you know, living and going to visit in these places and visiting landmarks and churches and stuff, especially in Latin America, Central America, you have these walls where that are just covered with ex-votos. And somehow the fact of seeing them all together, hanging together like this dense collection of people's wishes, I found that really compelling. And so originally my idea was to make a whole bunch of them and hang them all up, small boxes, but hang them up all together to make one big piece. And I never really got that far. I didn't get enough boxes done before I was on to something else because we moved and I saw something else, the guardian angels. And I had the same idea. I would make a whole bunch of them and hang them together. But then we moved again. So there's a bit of life that gets mixed up into the progress. And then Sailing to a Better Place, those cardboard boxes with the little marine scenes where you have a little boat that's going, navigating between two islands, one that's usually a dark place to the island of light. I have to say that that started around 2017,
right,
due to political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I really did feel a personal need to escape in my own work and look for positivity. And that's only increased since then. We won't go into it.
Yeah.
And then most recently, the, you know, Can't We All Try and Get Along? That also corresponds to this feeling of a personal need, as much as anything, to find joy in what I do and find, you know, a positive direction.
Mm. Yeah, there's undoubtedly that. There is just that sense, isn't there? There's always a hope for more, whether it's the fact that people have got these wishes or people have got guardian angels looking after them, or people recognize that things are missing, but the recognition that something like acceptance is the first step to recovery and all that sort of stuff, isn't it? So there's...
I would add that one thing really struck me when we did live in Central America and traveled around, and a lot of the neighboring countries, Costa Rica is kind of the Switzerland of Central America, and it's right. It's very, there's a big originally European population there, and they kind of got rid of their indigenous population early on. But obviously the countries nearby, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and then Mexico, you have all these different indigenous populations. And we would travel with the kids. I mean, traveling with the kids in these places was dynamite because they love kids. If you go there with little kids, they accept you.
Okay.
Because that makes you human. You're not just a tourist, a gringo tourist. And it struck me how much these people really, you could tell that they just pretty much wanted the same things as I did. You know, they wanted good lives for their children, better lives for their children. They wanted dignity. They wanted not to be judged harshly. They wanted probably to be loved and to love, you know, just the basic things that we all pretty much want, no matter which side of the polarized picture we're on.
Mm.
So that's something that I've always tried to depict in my work.
Yeah, and like you say, I think that ties back to this idea of your perspective and these different parts of the globe as well. That bit of, you're not bound up in small town politics. You've got the global perspective. You can see the humanity, and then you can kind of reflect that back and then make it a little bit wonky. Do you
love that word? I'm putting that one on the top of my vocabulary list.
The French people would be like, how dare you?
Tu es très wonky.
What itches, have you got itches that need scratching now? Have you got new ideas bubbling under the surface?
Well, I just closed a show here in my local village, and it was up for the month of September, and it was such a great experience because I've had trouble finding venues to show my work because it sort of, you know, flops over various media. I mean, it's kind of hard to define it as one thing or another. And it does have that quality that some people interpret as cute as opposed to wonky or whatever. So some galleries find it decorative. Other galleries find it weird. You know, again, it depends who you're dealing with. And this was a chance for me to mount a show in a space, small space, intimate, but very well lit, which made a big difference. Mm. So think about your lighting plan. and on my own terms, I got to do what I wanted with it. Mm. And I got to put all those votive boxes and guardian angels together on the wall and hang up Christmas lights and just do whatever I wanted to. So it was a great experience. And And the feedback from people coming in was wonderful, because most of them, I would say 99% of them, found it positive and encouraging. And they came out, you know, feeling lighter. There was one person who found it very negative. So there's always somebody in the group.
They're the people you need to talk to, though, right? Aren't they? They're the ones you want to be like, let's run around with that.
For a long time. Yeah. So I, for this show, I had just picked up the painting aspect of my work again, in the sense of, you know, the tapestry-like paintings with the layers and the quilted people in front. I used to do really big ones, and I had to put them all in a box in the laundry room because I had nowhere else to put them. I have no room in my studio. And I brought them out recently, and I thought, well, this was pretty good work. I wouldn't mind doing this again. Mm. So I'm not finished scratching that itch for now.
Are you in the same country as when you first made those?
No, actually, I started making those in Costa Rica.
Okay. So that's interesting, isn't it? Because you don't need to go back to Costa Rica to finish them. It's not geographically bound.
No. But then I kept going on them in France.
Okay.
When we moved back to France. So there is a bridge there.
Yeah, because it'd be interesting, isn't it, to see, you know, some of the projects that have been influenced by certain countries, and then if you move them to a different country, whether the language of the pieces changes.
Yeah, it probably does. The language, there are often landscapes behind in the background of these works, and I definitely use more French geographical spots in the paintings that I did in France.
Mm. I mean,
now I'm mixing it up.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm getting nods of the English countryside as well, but I mean, let's face it, they're not that.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely.
Yeah. It's very tasty. Now, that's amazing. Was it, I mean, doing your own show, because your worlds are quite contained, is it okay to do that? Or did you feel like maybe you wanted to, like, build even further? Like, you know, would you, sometimes I know I've spoken to a couple of other people and it's like their work, like even with Sally, you know, Sally's more likely to build a forest inside the gallery and then have her pieces in it. Did you ever feel like there was that inclination to really, like, explode it?
Totally. Mm. And if I had more space and more time.
Yes, if the laws of physics would allow.
I would love to. I did feel like as I was putting it up, you know, I got ideas every time I put something up, and I think, oh, I've got to add this, and oh, I could do this at the back. But I had some restrictions because it wasn't my space. So it was a space that was being lent to me, and I wasn't supposed to, you know, put holes in the walls or there were limits. I couldn't paint. I would have painted the walls if I could have, but I couldn't do that. You know, I had to hold back. If I had my own space to work with someday, I would love to let go. Absolutely.
Lauren World, just some kind of immersive thing where people are greeted.
Lauren Land.
But yeah, exactly, where people are greeted Land. By a giant slug on the way in or something that speaks in bubbles.
But when you talk about itching scratches, your animation suggestion is definitely one of them.
Mm. I mean, it might be that the marionettes would work if you can construct them, because you clearly, you know, you're clearly very adept at making worlds, because it's not just the characters in the fabric. There's lots of props and bits and pieces that you make. So, I mean, you've got that ability there to just build your own theatre and record your own. And maybe the marionettes is the shortcut, isn't it, to doing it?
Yeah. The software is the long cut, learning the...
Yeah, and just having the time to do the animation. Yeah, I mean, that's it. That's the sort of project that, yeah, you could spend a decade doing that and come out with a 5-minute showreel, couldn't you?
But there's another, now that I think of it, another itch. I don't know if you've interviewed or if you know about the the Red Dress Project.
Oh, yeah. So Kirsty, who I was talking about, where she traveled all over the place when she was a child. Yeah. So she's in the pipeline. Yeah, interviewed her.
Okay. Well, I just found out about her, you know, from link to link recently. Mm. And I was totally blown away by that project. And I, as much as I appreciate working on my own, because that's how I work the best, it is sometimes a lonely job. And working on group projects is a way out of that. And of course, hers was a worldwide group project, but I totally adhere to that kind of group aspiration to pull something so gorgeous and coherent out of so many different hands.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
I think,
and with such a strong message.
What occurs to me with the nature of your work is it would be more interesting if you were to do a group show with people from other media. So a storyteller or a musician or someone like, I don't know, because your characters are so strong and because of the way you do things. Like I was thinking, oh, you know, you could go and work with Sally, you're in the same ballpark, but I don't think it works like that. It feels to me like you would have better strength doing a group show with a musician or doing a group show with somebody who made stuff using ceramics or something, because you riff off each other.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Each other, and the cumulative whole is far more interesting. It's not just two people who roughly build the same things. When you get the people making the different things, someone who does stained glass, you guys would go gangbusters because some crazy amalgamation would come out of it. You know,
that's it. You're right about that. I agree with you. And there actually is. I mean, I have done it on a couple of occasions in my village in France. There's a castle, which is quite a unique castle because the village is along the Seine River. Mm-hmm. in a part of the valley where there are these chalk cliffs that rise up behind the village. And so the castle was originally built into the cliff. It's like a troglodyte castle.
Amazing.
And the later parts of the building were built in front of the cliff later on. And there's a great big stable area. And every 2 years, there's a biennial in this stable. It's called Oak Sebo, which means it's like a takeoff on Oak Sebo. Oh, how it's beautiful. And the premise of this biennial is to get two or sometimes three or more artists working in different mediums together to work on an installation on a theme. Mm. And I've done it twice now. And the first time I did it was with a ceramicist. And so we built this whole, I think there may be pictures on my website. We built this installation where you have these two life-size people who I mostly made. They're soft sculpture, but parts of them are made out of ceramics. So like the guy had ceramic ears and hands and feet made by my colleague she works with Raku ceramics, so these sort of beautiful crackly looking pieces. Mm-hmm. And she also runs a tea room in the village. And so our installation was this couple sitting in a tea room, and we made all the pastries and the and the teapot and all the decor between textile and ceramics.
And the pastries have got faces. Just
yes,
I see that now. Yeah.
Just so you feel guilty eating them. Uh-huh. It was so much fun. It was so much fun. And I did another one last year with another local artist who's sort of more outsider art. Mm-hmm. His practice is all involved in this one cave that he lives in and has turned into an altar to both creation and death.
Okay.
So we're a great pair. And we actually had a lot of fun together.
It feels, it does feel like sometimes, you know, those are just the logical things, isn't it? There are plenty of times when you can do a group show with people who are exploring certain themes within the same medium or something like that. But when it's people like you, people like Audrey, there are these people who, like, nobody else can really get in your way in the thing that you're doing because it doesn't serve either of you. So then you have to go left field, don't you? You have to think, you know, who's someone who's doing stuff with blown glass? Or recently here, like this weekend, we had the final weekend of the British Ceramics Biennial that they have in Stoke-on-Trent, which is nearby. And we love going to that.
I saw that on your Instagram, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely love that because I'm not particularly familiar with the medium, but I just love the variety and I love seeing these new forms and that the hard and the soft and just the interesting thought. And I think that's the thing, you know, maybe that's why it appeals to me more is because I see needlework all the time. So the freshness of this, like in one room, they did have this exhibition that was called Fresh. And I think a lot of the pictures I shared in my stories were just in this one room. To go and see six or seven people where you just like, oh, that's brilliant. Like, so like invigorating, but within about half an hour, you're just like, oh, I've seen like nine things or whatever that are amazing. Like, I kind of love that. And that's where, yeah, it just, everybody gets a bit elevated, you know, you doing something with a different medium. And I do feel like somewhere in there, music, theater, that kind of thing, it all ties in with the medievality of it, isn't it? Get yourself a lute, something or other.
I have one, but I don't know how to play it.
Of course you do. Of course you do. That makes perfect sense. No, that's great. That's great.
That was a project in my mind that I haven't taken off on yet, I would say, but I love musical instruments. Mm. I tried playing the violin when I was a kid, but I didn't put in the work. But I realized that the part of violin playing that I loved was the violin, was the instrument. And so I've often thought about creating my own textile cardboard instruments, I haven't figured out how to use them other than objects at this point.
Yeah, it feels to me like you probably end up having to give them some kind of animalistic legs. It feels like that's the way they're going to become beings, aren't they? That's just the...
They'll play themselves.
Yeah, exactly. That's in a strange mating ritual or something. That's amazing. I am going to segue now using music as a very tenuous link to the toughest section, because we've talked about world building and we've talked about language, linguistics and socio-discourse, all that stuff. So let's find out the tough questions of, do you have a favorite band or a favorite album?
As I told you, your questions are impossible to answer because you can see I've been around the block a few times and I've gone through so many phases.
Should we do you have a favorite album per continent? Would that work? In South America?
The sort of astute, I think, thing that I found to help me along with your questions is, you know that BBC radio program, Desert mm-hmm. Island Discs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for those people who don't know it, a famous person is interviewed by this wonderfully soft-voiced, kind woman. Mm-hmm. And at the end, they're going to be sent off to a desert island for the rest of their lives. And through the interview, they're allowed to choose...
Eight songs, yeah. One book, one luxury item.
And so in the end, they're allowed to take one of the songs, one book, and one luxury item. Mm-hmm. And so I figured I would put myself on the desert island for the rest of my life. And what would I choose? Because my taste goes all over the map, which is why, you know, Spotify playlists are really an ideal thing for me these days. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, it's got to be something that I can sing to and maybe even dance to mm-hmm. and listen to over and over again for the rest of my life.
Okay, yeah.
So I went back to the musical movie theater category of my likes. A movie that I watched and watched over and over again with my kids who loved it was The Sound of Music.
Okay. Yeah. Good shout.
And know all the songs by heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that was one choice. I was also thinking about one of the first jazz albums that I ever listened to and then played over and over again until it was like vinyl spaghetti was Ella Fitzgerald singing the Cole Porter songbook.
Oh, yeah. I think I've got that on vinyl, you know. That A Sunny Day in New York. And is it A Sunny Day? A Foggy Day. A Foggy Day. Yeah.
In London, isn't it?
It is. It's not even in New York. I did that. I should really go back and re-edit that. But no. But yeah, we've got Ella Fitzgerald and Dina Washington as well.
Yeah.
Those voices. Ah, that's a great. Actually, as well, I have got the Sound of Music soundtrack on vinyl as well because my wife. You can't go wrong with a musical. If Mary's in a mood, I'll put a musical on because in about three songs along, she'll be singing to it. If it's Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat or Les Mis. If she's in a right grump, bit of Les Mis, she'll be one day mooring in no time or whatever. But
I agree with her. And that was one reason why I chose it. That, you know, there are a few things, if I'm feeling down because of the complexity of the world that I can't understand or grasp, I either will put on like a musical and start singing to it halfway along or even before that, or making boat models. That's my other technique to bring myself out of the dumps.
Put the two things together in 5 minutes, you're back out the door, clicking your heels, running down the road. Oh, yeah. I tell you what, like just thinking about Ella Fitzgerald singing Cole Porter songs. I think there's a Gershwin one as well, like her singing the Gershwin songbook that we've got. And it's just such a great combination of songs. Even Love for Sale, which I think is a song about a prostitute. Even that's quite
Love
good.
For Sale, yeah, exactly.
Just trying to explain to my children, don't think too hard about those lyrics, girls. It's fine.
It's the songs and her voice. Yeah, just so
I even bought a little while ago, I bought Roberta Flack's, I think it's First Take, which is like her first album, and it's a lot of her just playing the piano. But the first time I ever saw Your Face is on there as well. And it's just like, they're just beautiful. It's just beautiful. That. Mm. Oh, that's put me in a right nice mood, that is.
good. I did my job.
Yeah, that's it. I'll be smiling now. Favorite book?
Okay, so favorite book on my desert island, where I also am allowed apparently a Bible item. And the complete
works of Shakespeare. So
that'll keep me occupied for a while. So I decided I'm definitely a fiction reader. I read to escape. I admit that with no qualms. But I figured that on my island, it would have to be a book with images illustrated somehow. And I remember back in the day when I used to listen to this radio program when before internet, I always thought I would take along an atlas, which is technically not a book, but, you know, it's got the whole world in its pages and you tell yourself stories about travels you would take if you... But I decided for today that I would take a book by one person who's a hero of mine, who's influenced me very much. Her name is Myra Coleman.
Okay.
Do you know her?
No. Cool.
I think she started off as a designer with her husband and is well known as an illustrator, both of children's books, but also books for adults now.
Right.
More. And this one book is that I love. It's called The Principles of Uncertainty. This is probably backwards. It came out originally in 2000, six or seven as a monthly series in the New York Times. So each month she would write a new chapter, and then it was published. But let me see if I can find you like an image.
I'm just looking her up now, I think. Am I? Maybe.
She makes these gorgeous gouache Matisse-like, but very, very personal images. This is a famous American TV personality, right, who she went to meet in New York. And she goes around the world looking.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes around New York looking. This guy is a classic character in Central Park. And the text is all sort of a mixture of total whimsy wonkiness and her own philosophy. And it's funny. And at the same time, the message is often, you know, the world is a crazy place and we're all doomed to die and things are a mess. So to pick myself up, I'm going to take the subway and go to Coney Island and follow people around. And it always works. You know, she sees all these different hairdos and collects unusual objects off the sidewalk. And then she tastes Mr. Shlibovitz's kielbasa, and, you know, daily activities that bring her back to just loving life. So,
yeah, it's interesting. It makes me think of, like, I've not been to Dubai, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are people that seem to think Dubai is great, but to me, it feels like Dubai is like an international airport, is like a lot of shopping malls, is like homogenized and stuff, isn't it? And that's where that is what gets us down about life. So going and finding the little bits of weird, a piece of rubbish that looks like an old lady's hanky, whatever. I don't, you know, that's, that restores our faith in humanity, doesn't it? The wonky, the weird, yeah.
And this author, collector, has opened in New York. It's sort of between Soho and the Lower East Side. There was a garage that she got a hold of. Mm-hmm. And it's not open all the time, but it's just, you know, a garage-shaped space with shelves in it. And she showcases her collections in there. You know, it's like an evolving show of her collections of maybe candy wrappers from around the world.
Right.
Or
yeah.
Superlative pickle jars from around the world, or, you know, movie ticket stubs. Or
I met someone once who had an awful lot of Eiffel Tower sculptures, like models.
Well, they would be perfect in there. Yeah.
Because there's a certain tipping point, like 3, you're like, 15, you're like, isn't it? Yeah, you got to get the numbers up.
I have, I would say, probably a world-class collection of snowballs. Mm-hmm. You know, the
snow globes.
Is
that the interesting fact that not a lot of people know? It probably isn't even that.
I could have put that one in.
Yeah,
but too many people know about it.
So I've got two questions. One is, when are you getting your little garage then? I feel like the parallels between you and Myra Kalman are pretty strong. So you probably, you know, life echoes sometimes, you know, there'd be nothing wrong with that. I'll ask you about a film, and then I'm looking forward to the final question, because if a massive collection of snow globes isn't an interesting fact, relatively speaking, I can't wait for the next one. Do you have a favorite film?
I have a ton of favorite films.
Mm.
Unfortunately, at my age, I don't remember them all.
No, that's fine. But I mean, yeah, I'd imagine, again, films with visual, I'd imagine.
On my desert island, if I had the wherewithal to play it, I picked An American in Paris. Again, a musical.
Okay.
Do you know that movie?
Do you know what? I'm not familiar with that one. She's a bit poor.
No,
I need to up my
game. You've got to show it to your daughters.
Yeah.
It's a completely splendiferous musical by Vincente Minnelli.
Right.
With Gene Kelly in the main role and Leslie Caron. And it gave me my... before I ever came to Paris, it kind of gave me my first Hollywood, you know, color film version of Paris that I've always been hoping Paris would live up to. And it almost does, but but not quite.
Almost. Yeah, I think
and the music is gorgeous. And again, it's Gershwin, I think. It's based on originally on a Gershwin piano concerto, but then there are all these other songs around it. So you can sing and you can dance, and it's beautiful.
I do feel that Paris's marketing has been so good, if you like, not by Paris, but by the rest of the world. I've been to Paris twice, and it's fine, but you don't float along on a romantic dream and get carried into, you know, it can't do all the things that you believe it can, isn't it?
It's no. Fine.
There's a film that sprang to mind. I don't know whether you've seen. It's called Toys, and it's got Robin Williams in it. It's like a Barry Levinson film. I was just looking it up again now. It's from 1992, about a toy making company, and that Robin Williams plays the son of the man who founded it. And it doesn't score very well because it's a bit kind of pointless and a bit weird. But at the same time, there's just lots of beautiful scenery, and there's like part of it set inside a field just filled with green grass, but a lot of the backdrops and things, just the artistic direction and the scenery and those kind of things, I feel like you'd probably like it because it has that sort of otherworldliness.
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it. I think if it's 1992, it fell through the cracks when I was having two babies in a row in Paris. And then nobody sort of clicked on it for me to pick up on.
Yeah, it's not a brilliant film, but I remember, I think I was working in like Blockbuster Video at the time when it came out. So I watched it three times.
Oh, okay, so you would know.
Yeah. But it was just, because it was just beautiful. It was just a really nice looking film, slightly let down by the story maybe, but, you know, watch it on 1.5 speed or something. You
probably just check it out. I love Robin Williams, so.
And this is one of those, it's not too wacky, but I think just some of the, I think it would appeal to you. You can message me later and be like, that was absolute garbage, Jamie. What are you talking about? That'd be fine.
Never do that. I would use diplomatic language.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. Thank you. There are other films. Just leave it at that. Okay. An interesting fact that not a lot of people know about Lauren Bat. This is good. I'm ready for this.
Well, it won't be surprising to you. A lot of people knew this, that I loved playing with dolls. I loved my dolls. My sister hated dolls. I loved dolls. And to the point where there were times when I would go to bed at night and we had these bookshelves in our room with all the stuffed animals lined up on them. And I would have to put every single one of mine in bed with me. Nobody could be left out because, you know, it would hurt their feelings. Mm-hmm. So to me, they were actual people, I think. But they were ideal people because, again, they didn't talk back to me. And since I was the youngest, that was a relief.
Mm-hmm.
I was the one who had to kind of try and scream to have my voice heard over the din. And so I love my dolls, and I ended up, you know, later on as I entered adolescence, and normally people give up their dolls. I found that really hard to do. So I kept them. I had a closet. We moved to another house. I had my own room with a walk-in closet, and there were shelves in there. And so I put my dolls in there where nobody could see them, and I could go in there and play with them from time to time. And then as I got even older, and it was really, frankly, it was the age where it was getting embarrassing to still have dolls. I spirited them upstairs into the attic. We had this huge attic with a kind of an actual room off to one side with bookshelves in it. And I installed them up there. You know, I made them a dollhouse up there. And they lived up there. They were really happily ensconced. I would go see them from time to time. I didn't really play with them anymore.
Can I ask how old you are at that point?
I'm definitely a teenager.
Okay, right. I thought you were going to say 34 for a minute. I was going to go. Oh.
No, but not all of them survived. And I'm talking dolls like not Barbie dolls. I had Barbie dolls, but she was not my thing. They were more like they were called Ginny dolls. I don't know if you had them in Britain. They were like little girl dolls that you had lots of costumes for.
Right.
From all around the world. And then there was the whole cast of Winnie the Pooh, the original sort of felted version.
Mm-hmm.
There were the Finnish Swedish Moomin Troll dolls.
Yeah.
And trolls, I adored trolls. I had a whole troll collection.
Mm-hmm.
And those, I never got rid of them. I still have them.
Mm-hmm.
I still have two of the Ginny dolls in a box. I don't play with them, but they're there. I still have the Winnie the Pooh dolls. I made copies for my own kids, the Moomin Troll dolls, and my troll collection. I still have them. They're like the most consistent thing that has stuck with me throughout the length of my life, I would say. These guardian angels.
Yeah. This is going to sound like a morbid question, but do you think they should be buried with you? It feels like maybe they should, because they used to spend an entire bed with you. You know, it feels like
they've already been buried with me. Gee, that's thanks for bringing that up.
Sorry to your kids for bringing that up, but you know, it feels like they're following you, aren't they?
But they definitely, I'll think about it. I mean, they definitely have had a formative role in what's become of my creative life.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the things that I work on, I have another ceramicist friend who talked about the fact that when she's working on pieces, you know, she'll carry them around her studio and she'll talk to them. Mm. And I realize I do the same thing with my own work.
They're like familiars, aren't they? You know, like witch's head. They're sort of like your...
You create your own family in a way.
Yeah. That's great. Lauren, thanks for having me in the exchange with me.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.